That people use to tell their political and cultural time of day. It is also a compass that people use to find themselves on the map of human geography. History tells of people where they have been and what they have been, where they are and what they are. Most important, history tells a people where they still must go, what they still must be. The relationship of history to the people is the same as the relationship of a mother to her child.
We're poor, Ashe.
Ashe.
We're poor to the creative spirit, the great Ashe out of which we all emerge, Ashe.
Ashe.
We poor to that creative spirit by whatever name we know it, whatever name you hold in your heart, in your mind, whatever name your ancestors gave, whatever name you learned as a child, whatever name you believe it to be, whatever name you believe it to be in spirit or in science, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to the first human beings who came into existence on this planet, the first human beings who raised the first structures, who cooked the first meals, who taught the first children, who had the first children, the first Africans, the first people who stood upright, who walked, who figured out how to stay on this planet, who figured out how to pass that knowledge on to their children and their children's children, the mothers and fathers of civilization, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour the next libation to their grandchildren, their children's children, those who raised the great early civilizations of Kemet and Kush and Mona Matapa, the great medieval civilizations of Ghana and Mali and Songhai and Kanem-Bornu. We pour to those who great the great civilizations of the Igbo people and the Hausa people and the Kikongo people and the Mbara people, the great Mande civilizations, the great Kikongo, the great civilizations of Southern Africa, the Bantu people, the great civilizations of Southeast Africa, the Dinka, the Shilluk, the Nuer. We pour to those millions who raised the foundations from which the world would learn what it meant to be human in the world, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to their children who, upon the arrival on the shores of people they had never seen before, found themselves captured and marched overland, found themselves perishing by the millions before they were held on the holding cells and the open air pens on the coast of West, Central, Southern, and East Africa. We pour to the ancestors who did not know as they were stripped of all clothing and sent denuded into boats, packed like animals and strewn their bones across the floor of the Atlantic and the Indian Ocean. We pour to them who in the last moment on Africa grabbed the sand and grabbed the dirt and put it in their mouths and understood that the only thing they might have to preserve their place in that continent was their memory of that place and their ability to pass it on to their children. We pour to them, Ashe.
Ashe.
We pour to those Africans and their children who finding themselves cast adrift in Santiago, Cuba, who found themselves cast adrift in Puerto Spain, Trinidad, and Port-au-Prince, Haiti, who found themselves cast adrift in New Orleans and Charleston and Mobile, who found themselves cast adrift in Salvador, Bahia, who found themselves cast adrift in Barbados and the archipelago that formed the Wayward and the Windward Coast. We found them in these places learning Portuguese and Spanish and French, whose often first words was, oh my God, oh Madre de Dios, who found themselves praying to survive and pass on to their children the memories we pour to those ancestors who are represented in the thousands buried in all the square miles of where we stand, and who sit here buried before us in 400 caskets forged of wood from West Africa with Adinkra symbols. Each one of them, each woman, man, and child, symbolic of millions. The children of those who could not be killed, we pour our shame. We pour to their children who somehow survived the hells of enslavement and fought for emancipation in the Caribbean, the French, British, Dutch Caribbean, who fought for emancipation in South America, who fought for emancipation in Central America, who fought the struggles we refer to as the Civil War in the United States, who came out of that, marched out of enslavement through Reconstruction, and found themselves making great migrations, eventually ending up in places like New York. Their children's children, who making a way for themselves became our great-great-grandparents, our grandparents, our great-grandparents, our parents. Those who, when the first bones were discovered in this space, held their hands and said, stop, no more. We are here to speak for those who can no longer speak with their mouths. We pour for those ancestors, some of whom came to Howard University in 2004 and followed these caskets all the way back to New York. We pray to the great ancestors, the ones whose names we know and the ones whose names we don't. And at this moment, as we pour this libation, I would ask anyone who feels comfortable to say the name of someone in your bloodline who is no longer physically here, but who you know made it possible for you to be here. Go ahead, let's hear the names.
Haywood Carr.
Porter Griffin.
Thomas Lee Jr.
Evelyn Glover.
We pour to the names that we hold collectively. Ganga Zumba in Brazil. Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Henri Christophe in Haiti. We pour to the great Avengers, Nanny of the Maroons of Jamaica. We pour to the great ancestors, Harriet Tubman, Sojourner Truth, Frederick Douglass. Say the names that you study. Who are the names of the ancestors that you have come to hold in your heart and your mind as you hope that you can do what they did for us, for your children and children's children? Let's say some of those famous names.
Malcolm X,
John Henry Clark, John Jackson, Jacob Carruthers. And finally, two final libations. We pour to those who make it possible for us to do what we do. We pour to these rangers who stand guardian over this sacred space. We pour to these Africans and these folks who have come from Howard University, the staff, the faculty, the administrators who brought us here today to bear witness. This is not a libation, but an affirmation, because their hearts still beat, their tongues still speak, their minds still think, and their minds still wish the best for us. We pour for all of those people who surrounded us on this journey today and made it possible for us to be here. We pour this affirmation of thanks, Ashe.
Ashe.
And finally, we pour to your children's children's children who will one day stand on this space and speak your name.
For My People by Margaret Walker. For my people everywhere, singing their slave songs repeatedly, their dirges and their ditties and their blues and jubilees, praying their prayers nightly to an unknown God, bending their knees humbly to an unseen power. For my people, lending their strength to the years, to the gone years and the now years and the maybe years, washing, ironing, cooking, scrubbing, sewing, mending, hoeing, plowing, digging, planting, pruning, patching, dragging along, never gaining, never reaping, never knowing, and never understanding. For my playmates in the clay and dust and sand of Alabama backyards, playing, baptizing, and preaching, and doctor, and jail, and soldier, and school, and mama, and cooking, and playhouse, and concert, and store, and hair, and Miss Chumbi and company. For the cramped, bewildered years we went to school to learn to know the reasons why and the answers to and the people who and the places where and the days when. In memory of the bitter hours when we discovered we were black and poor and small and different and nobody cared and nobody wondered and nobody understood. For the boys and girls who grew in spite of these things to be man and woman, to laugh and dance and sing and play and drink their wine and religion and success, to marry their playmates and bear children and then die of consumption and anemia and lynching. For my people thronging 47th Street in Chicago and Lenox Avenue in New York and Rampart Street in New Orleans, lost, disenchanted, dispossessed, and happy people filling the cabarets and taverns and other people's pockets needing bread and shoes and milk and land and money and something, something all our own. For my people walking blindly, spreading joy, losing time, being lazy, sleeping when hungry, shouting when burdened, drinking when hopeless, tied and shackled and tangled among ourselves by the unseen creatures who tower over us omnisciently and laugh. For my people blundering and groping and floundering in the dark churches and schools and clubs and societies, associations and councils and committees and conventions, distressed and disturbed and deceived and devoured by money-hungry, glory-craving leeches, preyed on by facile force of state and fad and novelty, by false prophet and holy believer. For my people, standing, staring, trying to fashion a better way from confusion, from hypocrisy and misunderstanding, trying to fashion a world that will hold all the people, all the faces, all the Adams and Eves and their countless generations. Let a new earth rise. Let another world be born. Let a bloody peace be written in the sky. Let a second generation full of courage issue forth. Let a people loving freedom come to growth. Let a beauty full of healing and a strength of final clinching be the pulsating in our spirits and our blood. Let the martial songs be written. Let the dirges disappear.
You are listening to Black Reality Think Tank with host Dr. William Rogers on Time for an Awakening Media, part of the Black Talk Radio Network. For podcasting or live program scheduling, hit them up at timeforanawakening@gmail.com.
Good afternoon and peace and greetings to all of you, my brothers and sisters. We got off to a little of a late start today, more technical difficulties, but that's okay. We got to hang in there and be resilient and keep things moving. I think we're on track now. We've got all of the equipment working in the way that it should. So I really appreciate you, though, for your patience and for you hanging in there last week when we're not able to get on due to some problems. And so anyway, we're back now, hopefully, and I think we're going to be okay. Thanks to my engineer, Brother Quay Koo. Thanks to my good friend, Tommy Bourdain, who does all of the computer repair for us. So we've got it going. So it just takes a little time. Again, thank you. We welcome you. We are here every Tuesday night from 7 p.m. Central to 9 p.m., 8 p.m. Eastern to 10 p.m. And we are here every Tuesday at the Black Reality Think Tank. I'm your host. My name is William Rogers. Tonight we have a program that we are calling Are We Headed for Self-Destruction? It's a lot of things going on in our world today, as you know. We want to do a sort of an open mic to give everyone an opportunity to see what their viewpoints are. We're all suffering the same thing. We're all under the same gun. So we can talk collectively from your perspective or what you think things are. And basically the bottom line is to aid our community in understanding and providing information that they may not have in reference to what's going on. And so that's what we're going to do tonight. We're going to get right into it. First, always, as usual, I like to do our ancestral profile. We honor our people, our ancestors, those whose shoulders we stand on, those who fought for us for a long, long, long time. So we want to pay honor to them. And tonight we honor a brother His name is John Edward Bruce. John Edward Bruce. Brother Bruce was known as Bruce Grit. That was his name. He was born February 22nd, 1856. And he was an American journalist. He was a historian. He was a writer. He was an orator, civil rights activist, and a Pan-African nationalist. He was one of the very early Pan-African writers. He was born in captivity in Maryland as an adult, and he founded numerous black newspapers along the East Coast, as well as he worked with the author Alfonso Schomburg and created an organization called the Negro Society for Historical Research in New York City. My kind of brother. During the American Reconstruction era, and after many black leaders espoused nonviolent strategies for social change, Brother Bruce was appalled at the rise of lynchings and the imposition of legal segregation. So Bruce supported an armed self-defense against racist attack. He is quoted as saying, "The man who will not fight for the protection of his people and for his family and for his wife and his children is a coward and deserves to be ill-treated. The man who takes his life in his hands and stands up for what he knows to be right will always command the respect of his enemy." He supported organized resistance to organized resistance. In Harlem, later in the later years in Harlem and Yonkers, New York, Bruce became involved with the emerging community of intellectuals, including a lot of the Harlem Renaissance forefathers, the newly arrived immigrants from the Caribbean. And in 1911, with Arthur Schomburg from Puerto Rico, he founded the Negro Society for Historical Research, first based in Yonkers. It was designed to create an institute to support scholarly efforts. For the first time, it brought together Africans, West Indians, and Afro-American scholars. This later became the foundation for the Schomburg Center for Research in Black Culture, which is a part at that time of the New York Public Library on Malcolm X Boulevard in Harlem. Brother Bruce also was a member to Herbert Harrison, the young migrant from St. Croix, who became influential in black socialism and black nationalism. Bruce's belief in an independent national destiny for blacks in the United States led him in the period around 1919 to embrace the great Jamaican leader, Honorable Marcus Mosiah Garvey, in his Pan-African nationalism. As a member of Garvey's Unia movement, Bruce wrote for the movement's paper, The Negro World, and he also wrote for the Daily Negro Times. Despite his productivity, Bruce found that to sustain himself, he had for most of his adult life to work for the Port of New York Authority. And after he arrived in 1922, he received a small pension until his death in New York City's Bellevue Hospital 2 years later. Bruce was given an impressive state funeral at the Unia Liberty Hall in New York City on August 10, 1924, and he was buried in Oakland Cemetery in Yonkers. More than 5,000 people attended three services conducted that day honoring him. Bruce was a Prince Hall Mason, a member of the Humane Order of African Redemption, and the African Society of London, now called the Royal African Society. My kind of brother. Don't hear a lot about folks like that, but there were a lot of our people back during those years who took those strong stances. And obviously, most of the mainline historical research is not going to bring that to light. And so there may be many people who may not have heard of Bruce, but a man of this caliber very clearly is one that stands out. And that's what we try to do here on the Black Reality Think Tank, is to bring those kind of folk to light so that we can look at them, go back and study some of their ways and their behavior. Okay, we are here. We are ready. We have our friends who are normally on our platform. They're here tonight, and I really appreciate again them. I appreciate their patience and your patronage, and we're going to keep at it. We're just not going to, regardless of what the odds are, we're going to keep going at it. Got a lot going on in our world. All of us are under this yoke right now of a virus. that's supposed to be of a pandemic stage, the virus that has shut down everything economically, educationally, socially, everything. All the institutions of American life have been shut down by a virus. And to many people, it's just not really clear on what this is and what it's attempting to do and what's being done. You know, we have to look at the history of our country. We, as Malcolm said years ago, we've been bamboozled and hoodwinked on a lot of stuff. And we're not sure if this is not just another stage of that system. And so tonight we want to talk about that, see what your opinion is, how it is. I have some real serious questions in my own mind and in my own heart and spirit about this virus and what it might be and where it's coming from and what the purpose of it is and why is it that it's been promoted in the way it's being promoted and creating a pandemic. I don't know if many of you, there was a similar kind of incident back in the early 20th century, 1920, 17, somewhere like that. They had a pandemic of this nature, and it created havoc. It was based on the influenza, the flu, and it was wiping people out. I remember in my time frame, the influenza one was before my time, but in my time frame, it was polio. Polio was supposedly had spread throughout America, and everybody was being forced to get these shots. And then the salt vaccine shot was used to counter it, supposedly. For a long time, you know, folks were stricken with that. So those kinds of things. And so we want to talk about those tonight. And then obviously the other part that we want to discuss is this election that we are embarking upon that will be happening in November of this year, and the conventions that are going to take place. One of them is in Milwaukee. The Democratic convention is in Milwaukee. I'm not sure where the Republican, I don't even pay any attention where that's going to be, but I know that one in Milwaukee is the Democrat. So, and just kind of looking at the primary, what happened, Joe Biden, Bernie Sanders, what is all of that about? Does it have any merit whatsoever? Is it just paving the way for Donald Trump to be president again? And so we want to look at that. And then again, the response to the virus. I just saw something on the news today that Trump is offering to send checks to people to help counter the economic expenses of this whole situation. Don't know the full merits of that. But again, tonight, I hope some of our panel can talk about that. And then also, I want to mention just briefly the situation that happened here in Milwaukee with Miller Brewing Company and the brother that went in and he attacked those that had been harassing him for years as an employee there and what that all meant. But there's a lot of political connotations to that. Just kind of mention a few what information or concerns or information that folk might have about all of that. So that's where we are tonight, and I'm really looking forward to your discussion. Good evening to all of you, my panel, that are on right now. I'm going to go right to the board and start to talk to you. As I said, the program tonight was we headed for self-destruction, and I had a photo that was on the promotion piece at Facebook of the four horsemen, the apocalypse. And so I'm asking the question, are we at the apocalypse? So if you would listen to some of these programs, you would think that we were heading for an apocalypse. So let me go over here to my brother, good brother James Pugh. Brother Pugh, is this the apocalypse or is this just a bunch of pocky cot mess that's going on in this country? How do you see it? What is your thoughts?
Well, if you're referring to the coronavirus,
yes,
I would say that I'm a Kool-Aid drinker. I mean, I think it's a legitimate event.
Okay,
and
right.
I think it's potentially catastrophic.
Okay,
because what it's the equivalent of, it's the equivalent of a hurricane in every city of the world that lasts for 3 months.
Okay.
So it's absolutely devastating.
Good enough.
Absolutely.
Do you recall? Do you recall? I know you look at. Do you recall any of the situation that happened back in around 1920 with that influenza that was the same kind of alarm set out throughout the country? And I really should have read some more about that before the program.
Wasn't it like 100 million people who died in the Spanish flu?
Exactly.
The reason for the Spanish flu was the fact that you had President Wilson who wanted to send troops to Europe, and he didn't want anything to discourage sentiment, because Americans were pacifists and didn't want to get involved in the war in the first place.
Right.
And so any excuse he felt would be a reason for them not to send troops over there. As a result, he sent infected American troops over there and exacerbated the problem even worse. And in fact, the only reason they call it the Spanish flu is that all the other countries involved, they were lying and not revealing what was happening to them. And the Spanish, they just happened to mention that, that there's this flu going on that's killing people.
Right.
And all the attention went to them. So it was an event.
And that's the thought that I had as well. And I'm glad you brought us up to historical date in terms of some of the parameters of that particular pandemic. But some of the groundwork for this one here is the same. Now it's not as active as going into World War I, because World War I had already started when this came on. But we've got some threat stuff going on here that I don't think we need to sleep on either. The situation with Iran and what happened there, and the situation with what's going on in places like Syria and things like that. We've got the making of that kind of stuff, and it seems that appears in a lot of cases when we are into that type of thing, you start seeing the executive branch and others doing some funny kind of ideas. So have you thought about that in terms of looking at some of the other motivations behind the pandemic scare and the way it's being done?
Well, I mean, if you were to think that, of course you can, you can just entertain any hypothesis.
Right.
But in terms of, it just doesn't seem. I mean, I don't know. I mean, it's possible, but I doubt it. And one of the reasons is that, from the point of view of the Trump administration, it's not been in their interest. Even for there to be an event.
Okay.
So
I just raised that because that's, I guess that's a part of some of the logic of conspiracy theory stuff. You always got conspiracy theories, floating around places, and I asked that in reference to that, because it seems that, everybody is not quite taking it as serious. And even Trump himself didn't take it really serious in the beginning. He was vacillating over what it is and what should we do and how should we respond to this coronavirus. And I was just wondering, could it be tied into political activity and agenda? But anyway, I thank you. Thank you for those comments. Let me go over to Sister Ayan. Sister Ayan, is this the apocalypse? Do we need to get ready to go home? What's going on from your perspective? Sister Yon, is that you?
I'm listening right now. I'm listening.
Okay. No comments?
A little later.
Okay. All right. Brother Griffin, you got any thoughts?
No, I'm just listening, sir.
Okay. All right. Well, I know Brother Timothy got some. Brother Timothy, is this the apocalypse? Is this are these the four horses coming to light that the book of Revelation talks about?
I will tell you this, sir. I think it's a lesson for us in hygiene and how we eat. I tell you that. And in fasting, some people do. Some people don't. We need to eat our foods that grow out of the ground, stop eating processed foods. I'm going to say this. whether it was germ, whether it's germ warfare or not. The message I always talked about in this book, The Fall of America, storing food, having things in your house like water, just in case things like this happen. He said, you know, you can always look out your window and know that America's falling.
Right.
In Philadelphia, I looked at the news today, and you had people in line. They had a lady in Philadelphia who bought 300 rolls of toilet paper. Now, we can't tell you this.
Right,
this
right.
Then you had, right. Then you had people who were getting groceries. But guess what white people are doing in Philadelphia? Guess what their line is?
Okay.
They're getting guns. See that? See that? We're trying to get food and water.
Right.
And they're getting guns. See, in other words, they feel as though this might be the time now. If I got to take something for somebody, I'm going to take it. But if somebody tries to take something for me, I'm armed. So whatever it is, you got to be prepared for it. And I will also say this, that I wouldn't be surprised that they were trying to decrease their population in Asia, and some of those folks came over here and it spread. And they didn't mind it spreading. And I believe that America likes what's going on, because if you look who's getting tests, people who have money, stars and actors. Now, I don't know what everybody else's pocket is here. It's all mine. But it looks like they're gearing to the rich.
Yeah.
And they'll be pulled out of this. And the people don't hardly have anything.
Right.
The working poor and folks like that. That it's here we go again with the class race,
right.
And here we go again. It's always a black. I feel people always say, "You always talking about racism." I'm a race man. Yeah, I'm a race man.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
This is my opinion, my position, and I think we all put it together like we do on talk radio with you, with your group. I think we're gonna come up with the answers. This is about solutions here. I like this. This is about solutions.
Okay. Okay, that's good. And I very clearly, I think I'm glad you brought up the population control concept, because there have been some interesting history around the ideas of population control and what's usually done by powers and governments in response to population control. But unfortunately, I don't have enough research to get right into it tonight. But that is a card to lay on the table. Now, how you play it, I don't know. It would have to be somebody who might be a little bit more knowledgeable about examples of how population control theories were put into action. You know, I mean, I know the concept. I know what the Malthusian theory was about. But, you know, what are examples of that? So I don't know that. But I'm glad you brought it up. Thank you. Thank you so much for bringing that up.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Brother White, You got into toilet paper? Were you able to find any toilet paper? What do you think that means when you can't go to the store and buy toilet paper?
Well, I don't know about toilet paper, but first of all, good evening to everybody on the show.
Yes, sir.
Uh-huh. Some of the information that I've received about this coronavirus is that 80% of the people that get it don't even need medical attention. It's the same symptoms of a cold. It comes and then it goes away.
Okay.
The people who are dying are mostly elderly people with pre-existing conditions.
Okay.
Like, you know, diabetes, heart disease,
right,
or respiratory diseases and stuff like that. And from what I understand, the percentage of people who die from the coronavirus, the people who contract the coronavirus, is 0.5%.
Right.
Know that children, young people don't get it. It doesn't have that much of an effect on pregnant women and their babies.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So it's kind of difficult for me to conceive of that of being a pandemic that most of the people that get it don't even have to see a doctor, it just goes away. You know, one thing, if you know anything about Europeans, Americans in this country, everything is about money.
Always.
The business of America is business. So when one thing is going on, with white people and what they're telling you, you have to watch something else.
Okay.
But something else is going on.
That's really the focus of this discussion tonight is what do our audience
I
think
noticed
that might
it
be.
In New York, they closed down all the schools, they closed down the restaurants, they don't want any meetings of people over 50 people at one time.
Right.
But they didn't close the stock exchange.
Okay. Interesting.
So now all of these businesses that are affected by the coronavirus, the airlines and all of these people, when all is said and done, for them to stay in business, they're going to have to borrow money.
Yeah.
So in the financial world, they're struggling. The coronavirus is a windfall.
Okay. That's a good point. Good point. Did they close Las Vegas? Is Vegas closed? Have you heard?
I haven't heard anything about it. I'm not sure. I couldn't say.
Yeah. I know the casino here in Wisconsin is open. I mean, just closed. They just closed that today. It's a hotel casino. But I was wondering if Vegas is closed. All right. You're right. Wall Street's not closed. That's definitely not closed. And I think you got to look at all those little things. And by the way, to those of you who are on the switchboard, I have opened up your mics in case you want to just hone in and raise a point. But be mindful of that, though, in terms of background noise. But your mics are all open to everyone who has called in to the switchboard. So if you want at any point to just make a point, just go ahead, go right along and do that. But you're right, Brother White. I think that very clearly those are indicators that we have to discuss and look at because of the fact that, it could be great. And then that virus, the one that we talked about before in 1920s, in the influenza, there's a guy that had just written a book about it, but he wrote a book about that influenza. And he said one of the things was that people's doubts about it ended up killing a lot of folk because they were doubting it, and so they didn't really pay attention to it, and it then began to wipe out everybody. And so it was so bad, according to his book, that people were, the old firehouses were riding down the streets in carts saying, bring out your dead, bring out your dead. And folk were bringing out the dead from out of the house. Kind of reminds me of the New Orleans situation. They were during Katrina, a lot of houses, they were dead bodies in there. They didn't know what was in there. And so they had to
hide. One other point is that when they come up with a vaccine, how much is that going to be worth?
Oh, yeah. And the person that comes up with it, how much is they going to make?
How much is the pharmaceuticals going to make on a vaccine?
Right. And these are the things that I wanted to raise. You're right, exactly. Because that is an issue. Somebody's working on it. You know that.
But one of the things, though, is that, the kind of issues you're raising, people are aware of that. People are aware of profiteering and whatnot. And, I think that one of the things you see is a heightened awareness of people in this country about, capitalism and right. its machinations.
Right.
In fact, one of the things people are saying now about the different bailouts is, recognizing that, in 2008, all the bailout, went to, Wall Street and it didn't, affect, the people, and it certainly didn't help black and brown people. So there's a different kind of consciousness. So I think that, to me, if anything, it suggests that there's going to be a different response this time than in previous previous events.
Mm-hmm.
But by the way, one of the reasons for the pandemic nature of this is that America and every country has finite medical facilities, and they're looking at the exponential increase of infections, and as you said, if only 20% of the people actually need to be hospitalized, the problem is that when they need to be hospitalized, they need to go to ICUs. And America's healthcare system is really not, well, actually no healthcare system is designed for massive numbers of people who need ICUs. And what they're concerned about is that they can end up with the situation they have in Italy right now, where they don't have enough ICU units. And as a result, they've got a triage system set up where there's some people they just sit on the side and let them die because they know they don't have enough machines for everybody.
Right.
So what they're doing in America with this social distancing is they're attempting to they call it flattening the curve. And what they're attempting to do is to reduce the rate of increase of infections so that when you get that 20% that need to go to the hospital, that number won't be so big that they will overwhelm the medical system.
Okay, right, exactly. Anyone have any thoughts on maybe why this was hit so heavily in Europe and say, for instance, places like Africa nowhere near those kind of numbers in Africa. Any thoughts from anybody about that the geographical nature of this virus?
Well, one thing immediately is Wuhan was the they called that the Detroit or you know the sort of manufacturing center of China, and obviously you know with this low cost production model, you've got most of the countries in the world. Essentially, in fact, they were talking about how integral China is to everybody's supply chain, that there's something everybody has to buy from China to do whatever they're doing.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that you can see with Africa is that precisely because of the lack of integration of Africa into the world economy, you're not going to get the kind of interaction with African people and, you know, these, you know, and the foreign players. So I would think that's what's going on is that which in this case it turns out to be helpful, even though the assumption is that since African medical facilities you know in terms of their having these ICU set up that you're going
to
need these respirators and whatnot. It suggests that that it'll be a devastating situation if it should hit. But you know the keys to defending against it, aside from social isolation, is doing things that strengthen your immune system.
Right. Exactly.
Like eating foods that strengthen your immune system and rest and so on. So there's some public health things that can be done to. Decrease the morbidity of the of the virus.
Okay. All right.
This is Ayan.
Yes, go right ahead.
Yes. My phone battery went dead. I had to grab another one.
Okay.
But greetings to everyone.
Greetings.
And I like what I've heard so far.
Okay.
Some stuff was really on point in terms of what my belief system is. And first and foremost, I do not trust anything that the Caucasian does, especially America, when they claim something to be something, whether it's the Ebola, everybody and their mama was going to get Ebola. And then there were several viruses that were these huge threats that turned out to just fizzle out. So I don't trust anything that they say, especially when it's spread all over the media. I also know, or I'm aware of, the theatrics that they put into scaring people, that goes into scaring people, and the crisis actors and all of this other stuff. So along with that, I have a friend who is a doctor, and he, a medical doctor, but he has a holistic clinic. We had a conversation about this virus, and he said very simply that he administers vitamin C via IV, because that's one of the treatments that he makes available for folk, just high doses of vitamin C to boost the immune system, and everybody's fine.
Okay. Interesting.
That's it. Vitamin C.
Vitamin C, okay.
And he said his clinic is being flooded with people getting these IV administered vitamin C treatments, and then they're going on about their business, and they're fine.
Okay. Where's his clinic?
So is it local? And simple. Mm-hmm.
It's local in Greensboro?
Yeah.
Okay.
So basic and simple. And if this were such a pandemic and why is the media, I don't expect anything from Donald Duck, but why is the media not saying, take vitamin C?
No, it's not that, Sister Yan. It's the comorbidities. In other words, you may be healthy, you may be taking vitamin C, but if you interact with someone that isn't as healthy as you, they don't have the resilience that you have. And so that's what they're concerned about. In fact, that's one of the problems is that young people are, largely going to be immune to, the worst effects of the virus. But the problem is that they're going to be bringing it, to their parents, to their grandparents, and to other people who don't have the, the sort of strong constitutions that they have. And that's what's going on. So.
Now, to your point, what I was going to say is that it's as has been said. This is primarily, we've been told that it's going to affect people that are elderly, weak immune systems, and whatnot. So my point is, in all of the scaring of the population or the attempts at scaring the population, there's one very simple treatment or something proactive to do is to build your immune system with vitamin C. That's just not being reported from what I've heard. But the fear mongering is just all over the place. So,
actually that's one of the major things. They've talked about, the American healthcare system, how expensive it is and how much money is spent. And what they've done is they've moved away from public health and what you're talking about, vitamin C and immune system boosts and so on. These are public health remedies. And the problem is that you can't make a whole lot of money on those. But on the other hand, they emphasize clinical type treatments such as the respirators and so on. And so that's part of that capitalist problem that's coming in is that the people who have incentive to talk are the people who stand to make a lot of money. And as a result, they monopolate the airwaves. So yeah, I hear you that, yes, the public health strategy. In fact, that's one of the things that's being taught. See, there's some transformations going on. People are recognizing that these problems are related to the kind of society that we have and right. that this capitalism, it manifests itself all over the place. And so there's going to be a lot of lessons learned as a result of this. I'm one, as I said, I'm a Kool-Aid drinker who thinks this is a legitimate pandemic.
Any thoughts from anyone on the fact that one of the leading names that came up in the beginning of this virus was Iran? And obviously, considering what has happened there prior to that, do you think there's any connection between that situation and their name coming up? And I know there were people in Iran that were dying from it, but it's interesting that they came up right along with China as the two areas of the beginning of this thing. Any thoughts on what that might be? Is that some politics stuff, you think? Anybody have thoughts on that?
Like it's with smallpox.
Say it again.
Like it's with smallpox.
Oh, okay. All right. Brother Timothy, what you think?
Well, I remember a while ago, it might have been 30 years ago, that I think in China you could only have two children, and I don't think the Asians always followed that rule. So that was almost 20 years ago, 30. So what's going on with them? And they claim that, here we go again, hygienics, what you eat, what you put in your mouth, you are what you eat. Heard they eat bats, they eat dogs, they eat cats.
Right.
It's a different culture, I guess. And I guess it gets in your system as a result of it. It goes to other people. See, how much is that is true? Since they said the AIDS started in Africa, because I don't this part, they said that blacks were having intercourse with animals. I don't believe that. So, you know, they put those rumors out there when it could be a mad scientist, like this scientist is who's mad, this Caucasian, comes up with an idea, you know, and somehow it might have got to Asia, and they probably got mad scientists in China.
Okay.
And they got mad scientists in Japan. The thing is that I don't know totally. That's the problem.
Right.
You really don't know.
Yeah, you really don't. Yeah. And that's the thing. Now,
that's how they want you to think. And they don't want, they want you, that's how you know this clever devil, he gets away. His whole idea, he throws you off base to do what he has to do. And like you said, something else is behind this too.
Yeah.
It's a method to the madness. Yeah.
They are masters at distraction. And, you know, my position is that we need to keep our eyes open, because I have spoken with so many people that I did not even expect to respond the same way. And that's that a lot of people are not, black and white, are not trusting this. This is suspect to
exactly,
many people.
Exactly, exactly. It's really not just
something. And I think people are so tired of getting the world pulled over their eyes. We've got to be suspect. What is going on behind, like Brother Timothy was saying, behind this?
Okay.
Because every time they get ready to invade someone or do something horrible to the populace, you know, there's all of a sudden there's a war coming on. Or this country has got a dictator that you got to take out, you know. And or some kind of, like I said, virus or some crazy stuff. And
well,
the other thing is that there's this show, we might have mentioned this in the past, the symptoms, where a lot of things that actually occur in this country are on this particular cartoon, like years ahead before these things actually happen.
Right, exactly. My brother at 917.
Before you get back to it, can I say something, Doc? I'm going to say this, though.
Go ahead.
If Shet Philadelphia down, we don't have to go back. We got 2 weeks off from the public school system, and the small local businesses, you can't gather in them. They have to sell food out, takeout, right? And it's interesting because it's almost like I wasn't doing Hoover's time, but Hoover was known for the Depression. But this right here is Depression with disease. So this is an interesting spin. And and Philadelphia is a ghost town.
Okay. Okay.
People are not out in the town, they're not in the community. You know, you got to be so many feet. We got to bump elbows. You know, you got to have your sanitizers on. You know, people have walking around with masks in the front of their face.
Yeah.
I was like, people in California doing it. They tell me people in Florida are on the beach, though. Like, it ain't nothing going on. They say where the heat is, it doesn't affect you. I don't trust this cracker. Excuse my language. He's destructive. And, whatever I have to do to avoid it, I'm going to avoid it.
Okay.
Well, one of the things we can do is if we wanted to go down that conspiracy line, you would say that, for example, if you took the worst case and you said, you know, there are these operators, you know, who, you know, have some things, who have some design. So the next question becomes, okay, well, what would their next move be? And secondly, how can you counter that? In other words, once you assume that there is some kind of conspiracy going on, then the next question becomes trying to anticipate, you know, what kinds of things would be done and what could you do about it. Right now, the assumption that you're going to shelter in place and that you're going to try to avoid, contacting, touching your mucous membranes and all that. I mean, you know, whether there's a conspiracy or not, you can still do that. So I would say to the people who believe that there's some kind of, you know, diabolical thing going on, uh-huh. to take the analysis to the next level and say, okay, well, what's step two that they're going to do? What's step three? And what's step four? And then, therefore, because then we can start saying, well, okay, what can we do about this? You know, how, you know, and so on.
Okay.
But that's not possible because we're dealing with con artists who are always 50 steps ahead of us. So by the time we get to number four, they're on 54. I think the best thing we can do is take care of ourselves and pay attention to patterns of behavior because they, mm-hmm. one of the strategies that this fix system, this twisted system uses is dividing and conquering. And with having people isolate themselves and separate themselves, that is deeply concerning to me. Now, here in North Carolina, people are pretty much going on about the business. I don't see any mask or anything like that. You know, so I don't know if there's more fear-mongering in certain areas. I think it's really important to pay attention to patterns of behavior because I was thinking about AIDS. Somebody mentioned AIDS.
Right.
How did AIDS start off as a white homosexual disease, primarily? White male homosexual disease. And now, 2020, the primary people that are affected by AIDS are black people.
Right.
How did it move from there to here?
Good point.
Yeah, so there's no way of knowing the kind of the enemy.
I believe it's young black women.
Until they strike.
Right, yeah, black women. Black women.
Eyes open. And one more quick thing. I'm looking at commercials for those, I think they're medications or vaccines that are supposed to prevent AIDS. Maybe they take them before sexual activity. Most of those commercials are geared toward black folks.
Yeah, I've seen some of that. I've seen some of those commercials.
Yeah. Toward black people. So we got to keep our eyes
open. Yeah, I've seen some of those commercials. My brother at 917, any comments you have?
You know, yes, doctor.
Yeah, I wanted to see it. I know he kept. The brother at 917, any thoughts?
No, I'm just listening. Thank you, though.
Okay, good.
I'm very interesting, you know.
All right,
I mean,
okay.
I'm in tune with everything everybody is saying, you know, because there's really no way you can tell what this crack is up to. You know, right. You be looking to the right, he hitting you from the left. So, you know, we just got to, you know, got to go back and look to the ancestors for help.
Okay. All right. I agree. Brother Pugh, what were you saying?
Well, yeah. In fact, one of the articles that I was reading just before I came on, is they were talking about James Buchanan, the Nobel Prize-winning economist, and the kind of conspiracy that he developed, you know, basically. In other words, when you start talking about hostility toward black people, that's what they're talking about, is that beginning in the 50s, he began, you know, a systematic effort that has led to the kind of, to the forces of Donald Trump, for example. So there are conspiracies and there are folks, you know, that have all kind of diabolical things in mind. And certainly, you know, so that's true. But one of the things, though, is that you don't want to get paralyzed by that. And in order to not be paralyzed, it means that, you need some kind of action plan. And then Sister Yan is really good with this mental health part, this ideal of just like, you know, you got to keep your immune system strong, you also have to keep your emotional system strong. And so things that, you know, people can do so that they're not simply overwhelmed by, you know, by
good
fright.
Idea.
In fact, I saw something on Facebook today where the fellow, he had this quote from the movie Apocalypto, where the fellow said that, he was talking about fear and how debilitating it could be. I can't remember the exact quote, but I think that, you know, that's a key element of our mental health is us figuring out how to manage paranoia.
Right, exactly. And that's a real, that's real too. That is. As a matter of fact, that's the guy that wrote the book on the 1920 pandemic said that a lot of the deaths contributed to the fact that people overreacted to the to the whole thing. I mean, it was an influenza a virus, but, you know, it was just it was more overreaction to it than it was anything else. Yeah.
Dr. Rogers.
Yes, sir.
The coronavirus is the object. What is the subject? We're watching the coronavirus, but what's really happening?
Right. That's
as Brother Timothy just mentioned about the Depression. During the Depression, the very rich, powerful families did very, very well. They profited off of everybody else's misery.
Right.
So I heard on the news that by the end of May, the airlines would have to declare bankruptcy.
Right.
All of these people in all of these situations, the small businesses and all that, are going to have to rely on the banks to survive.
Yes.
Those are loans with interest. These are people who are operating at a profit and didn't need to borrow money, and banks make their money off of lending and interest.
Right.
They need people to be in trouble and to have to borrow money.
That's true.
And for you to, if you understand the history of white people and the things that they have done, starting with them bringing us over here, thinking that they up to something is not conspiracy theory. That's good sense.
That's deep. Yep, you're right. You're really right.
And to add something, they are always conspiring. When I say they're 50 steps ahead of us, they are always conspiring.
Yeah. I mean, that's the nature of capitalism.
And you can't doubt. We can't doubt, you know, that there's some kind of sinister thing going on behind all of this.
Right.
You just said, Dr. Rogers, capitalism.
Yeah, that's the
issue. Well, one of the things, if you read Ibram Kendi's book, Sam, From the Beginning,
right.
He makes the point that there are different strands. In other words, there are groups who every day of their life is about the destruction of African people. There are other groups who every day of their life, they're concerned about something else. And so one of the things is that there are different kinds of motivations that different white people have. And that's one of the our strategic advantages. You know, you talk about divide and rule and them wedging us, turning us against each other. Well, the reality is that same divide and rule logic works against them, since all white people don't have the same objective, right. Even with respect to black people.
That's right. I recall back some time ago when the magazine Scientific American was out, they had an article in there about there was a gene, G-E-N-E bomb, that had been created that could attack certain DNA systems and not attack other DNA systems, that it had the ability to do that. It was sort of in the development stage at the time the article came out. It had been tested in animals, as always, and that, say, the bomb could kill all rats, but it wouldn't kill rabbits, and it was created in a way to do that. Now, I don't know where that ever went and how it ever got, because I don't remember the name of it. But that type of technology and effort, I think, is still at work. We know what, a HARP system, the HARP kind of technology can do, and how it can alter natural earthly things, including our own psychology. I think it was East Germany had developed some technology that where they could do something and alter your consciousness and make you do crazy stuff. So the point I'm making is that this virus is not far off from all of that. And these were things that were proven and discussed. So right now we are caught in the mix of this, and we can't rule this out. some of the things that you all are saying very clearly is possible.
Well, one of the things, though, if when you look at the morbidity of this virus, when you start talking about it killing people who are up in age and who have other kinds of pre-existing conditions, that's really the profile of the white supremacist.
Yeah.
That's the profile of the Trump voter, of the Fox News viewer. So, in fact, that's even the profile of the wealthy, you know, of the wealthy, you know, the wealthy people in this society.
Right.
So if anything, you know, this virus really hurts them worse. But with respect to the other thing you were talking about, you know, the whole ideal of personal genetics where, you know, they're, you know, presumably coming up with genetic responses tailored to you as an individual. There are any number of really ugly, evil things that they're planning with genetics and whatnot that they're doing, you know, in labs all around the world and whatnot. So there's no question that, in fact, that's the reason I say technology is a crime, absolutely. In other words, it's not technology is not a neutral thing. It's a criminal thing.
It's a criminal thing.
And it's just
thing,
a question of when that criminality is going to manifest.
Right. I agree. Okay, let's go to Bernie and Biden, the two B's, B and B. What's going on with that, anybody? I'll just throw it out to the general audience. What are we seeing, the whole B and B situation? Is this anything that we need to make reference to?
Well, I would say this. One, Bernie's ideas are driving this country right now. This country is more in an FDR type mood, and that's the Bernie mood. The problem, though, is that Bernie himself is not viable, and I think he needs to get out. But yeah, in terms of everything that he wants done, that's what's going to happen in this country. So.
Okay. Right. Any other thoughts? Bernie? And again, everybody's mic is open, so you can just chat right in if you have some thoughts.
Well, I'll say this. You know, it's like a choice between frick and frack. It just doesn't make any sense. Bernie's electability is very questionable, as Brother just said. I actually had a conversation with a family member who's a Republican and drives me nuts, just the level of denial that member is in about the attack against black people. But Biden is showing signs of being senility, just as Trump shows signs of being a psychopath. And yet, black folk get on the bandwagon with Biden. His political history, he's been shown to have done all kinds of racist things against the black community. And that is always my primary concern.
Right.
A lot of his legislation, policies, and whatnot that he supports or enacted were downright racist. And the recordings are there, the video's there, so you can't deny it.
Right.
And yet we black folk, Michael Eric Dyson, of all people, endorsed Biden. Like, what is wrong with us? Are we that sick that we would get behind a person who is not going to, none of them are, going to do anything for the benefit of black folk, but just his blatant racist past and still get behind this character, and he's senile? He can't remember things. He gets distracted. He babbles. Pay attention to this guy. Mentally, he's not fit. Yeah. Cognitively, he's not fit.
Well. I would say that first of all, you're correct that Biden has lost several steps, and he is not the person that he was even 10 years ago. And so the real issue is whether or not he has the capacity to change the country for one term. I don't expect that he's going to be running for two terms. Secondly, I suspect that the reason that Barack Obama picked Biden was because he was a racist. Because what Barack needed to do as a black man is he had to assure white people that he wasn't a threat. And the best way to assure white people that he wasn't a threat was not by getting some white liberal who they would be equally afraid of, but by getting a good old boy that they knew would slow Barack's roll if Barack tried to do too much. But what's happening right now, though, is that because the country itself has moved, the ground itself has shifted. So as a result, the kind of racist policies that Biden built his career upon, he couldn't build a career on those policies anymore. Those policies are no longer popular. That's what I'm saying. The policies of Bernie Sanders are the actual popular policies. But let's be clear about one thing. You know, Cornel West had a critique that I thought was only partial. His critique of Donald Trump, he called him neo-fascist, that, you know, he wanted to create a world, you know, where whites rule. His critique of Biden, he called him neoliberal, that he wanted to create a world where money rules or market rules. And his defense of Bernie Sanders was that Bernie Sanders was a neo-populist. But the reality is that the reason that, for example, Bernie Sanders is having very little traction among black people is because, remember how the whole thing is that Barack Obama would not say black if we had to, you know, demand that he acknowledge us as a people? Well, that's the same thing with Bernie Sanders. The whole ideal of Marxism is that the only variable that's supposed to matter is class, that race itself doesn't matter, that gender itself doesn't matter.
Right.
And that's one of the problems that I think. So to finish my trio, you know, the neo fascism, the neo liberalism, the neo populism trio, is that the fundamental problem with Bernie Sanders is his ideal is that workers rule. And you know how the game, you know how it is in Milwaukee. In fact, you're going to talk about the killing at Molson Miller. Is that, you know, workers, that means white workers. That means white unions that, you know, right. that you know, it wasn't until right. recently that our unions even had any, you know, any kind of purchase at all. So what I'm saying is that the same kind of gangster policy that you get from Trump in the name of white people, that you get from Biden in the name of the dollar, you'll get from Sanders in the name of white workers, because we know how they get down. In fact, that's why there were those five fellas killed in Milwaukee, is because of that kind of white union spirit that that Bernie Sanders represents.
Right.
Can I say something? That was very good, sir. Okay, I would say this, that interesting analysis that you did with the trio. Now, in the midst of that, I want to know the black agenda. See, that's my thing. The guy, Tom Sawyer, whatever his name was, he talked about reparations. I like that.
Okay.
Now, right, in the midst of all of that, like you said, the socialists, the reason why the socialists and the Nazis don't get along is because, you know, they want to have integration. And the Nazis are saying, we pull our resources together, we want land, country, flag, and a way to perpetuate ourselves and to perpetual movement through our future. Okay. What the socialists saying, who are integrationists, that they want a race mix. They want a race mix. And race mixing, in the name of the revolution, that once you take the ruling out, and they only see and they around black people, white folks don't want to listen to black people.
Right, exactly.
So you go again fighting them, and they're your enemy, your open enemy, they're next to you. So when he's using socialism, what the Republicans are going to say is that, oh, like we talked about Paul Robinson, like we talked about Langston Hughes, in their mind, he said democratic socialism, but in their mind now, you're removing their capitalist government, and you want to share, you want to give away free stuff. And you and I know that socialism couldn't make it in America.
Right.
So if he gets there, If it took Barack Obama forever to get the health care passed, Barbara Pelosi had to help him the first and second term, how is he going to get free education?
Right.
How is he going to get free health care? And I'm for that. Listen, I don't owe any more student loans, but listen, anything else I could get that I've been working for anyway,
okay,
and you can help my family, and your family, Dr. Rogers, yours and yours and all, let's do it. I mean, and let's step on the record. Let's step with the reparations too. But Bernie Sanders said he's not for reparations, but he wants us to have socialism. Well, how are you going to have socialism and you're not going to have reparations for black people?
Yeah.
I want to know the black agenda.
Yeah. I just saw a note.
Dr. Rogers.
I just saw a notice come across that Biden has just won the Illinois primary, and he's also won Florida, which just about assures him of the presidential nomination. But yes, sir, 917.
I'd like to ask any of your guests, could they name one president that had black people's interests at heart since we've been in America?
Say that once more. Say it once more.
Has there ever been one president since we've been in America that had black people's interests at heart?
Yeah, right.
Here's a better question for you, brother.
Can you name one president who was
not hostile toward black people?
Wait a minute. I tell you one. Marcus Garvey, he was the president general. He was the presiding officer until one was provided. Marcus Garvey.
Okay.
What
do you say, Brother Pugh?
He was the president until one was provided.
There have been no white presidents or no president of America who hasn't been hostile toward the interests of black people.
That's right.
However, I think that 2020 is the beginning of a change of that.
Oh, really?
A lot of reasons. The world itself, in other words, one of the things that happened at the end of World War II is that, what Martin Luther King was saying about this ideal of what are the implications of nuclear weapons, what are the implications of pandemics? One of the things that happens is that the world itself is a different kind of world, and as a result, it's going to require a different kind of mentality. But that's one of the problems with these kind of empire builders, you know, that want to eliminate the race and eliminate, in other words, sort of produce, you know, sort of a homogeneous kind of people, is that they don't recognize that for everybody's sake, everybody needs their own space.
Right. Exactly.
The Electoral College is who actually puts the president in office. Am I correct?
Uh-huh.
Yes.
So why do we vote? If the Electoral College makes the decision, what impact do the typical American have on deciding who's going to become president if it's up to the Electoral College? I mean, I'm just trying to find out something.
Because you determine who the electors are going to be. You determine who the people are going to be in the Electoral College.
Yeah.
Very good.
We determine who the Electoral College is.
Right.
Okay.
They've rigged the system so that places where we're at, our votes are relatively minor. In fact, you know, the classic example is that California has about 40 million people in it. Their representation in the Electoral College is not much different than the representation of Wyoming, which I believe Wyoming maybe has 500,000 people. So, you know, there are some serious problems. In fact, it was designed precisely to make sure that states that had blacks enslaved in it didn't have more power because they had more people than small states, you know, that didn't have a lot of people enslaved. But these are some of the systematic changes, you know, that have to be done. In fact, one of the things just to mention, remember Jesse Jackson, when he won in 1984, he went to the Democratic National Convention, changed the rules because it had been winner take all. He changed the rules to proportional representation so that in a primary, if you don't win, if you win 40% of the votes, you get 40% of the delegates. Whereas when Jesse was running, the only way you get any delegates is you had to win the majority of the votes. Well, by Jesse changing the rules for delegate apportionment, that enabled Barack Obama to defeat Hillary Clinton because Hillary Clinton got more votes than he got in Nevada, got more votes than he got in Texas, but Barack was still able to get delegates. So what I'm saying is that one of the things we have to do is that it's sort of like in athletics, they talk about playing without the ball, that we have to, you know, recognize what our hand is and then, you know, make what moves we can make. You know, there was a time, if you looked at the end of the Civil War, our ancestors strategically were concerned about white men raping black women.
Right.
And believe that strategically that the thing that they could do is get them an education, and therefore that would reduce the amount of rape of their daughters. Well, right now, the most educated group in America are black women. So there are changes that we can make over time if we identify strategically what it is we want to do and then simply persist in doing it.
Right.
Yeah, I agree with you on that, but the president had nothing to do with that. That was for my own doing. We done that on our own. We didn't have to have the president tell us, get our kids better educated, and as you say, rates went down or whatever. I understand all of that, and I agree with you on that. There's a sister named Margaret Kimberly. She just wrote a book called Presidential. And not one of the presidents, she got everybody there from George Washington to Donald Trump. Not one of them. That was the name thing for black people, according to her.
Right.
And if the president gets in there, no matter who it is, it's got to represent the corporations and rich people. Am I correct?
Right.
Correct.
Well, see, but that's where we come in. If we change the paradigm, right now the game that they're playing is this kind of capitalist game. But the game itself is played out. And one of the things that you, in fact, in other words, there's a debate that you have to win. It's an intellectual debate. In other words, whatever you're going to do, whenever people fight wars or whatever, they're fighting wars over ideas. We have the best ideas. We have the winning. In fact, the reason that Donald Trump and them were deplorables and wanted to tear down the system and all that is because they felt they had been defeated by the ideas of Martin Luther King. They were in a situation where they were ashamed to say that they were racist, right? That's a sign that they had been defeated by Martin Luther King. The challenge that we have is that we have to advance a vision of the world that enables us to prosper. And that's what we're doing slowly but surely.
According to Claude Anderson, after we got emancipated, we control 0.5% of the wealth. In 2020, we control 0.5% of the wealth, according to Claude
Anderson. And the reason for that, now, we elected a black president. We gave this black president, he had the keys to the kingdom. He had a position, you know, after the global financial collapse, he had the ability to transfer wealth in this society. But because he didn't have a black vision, in fact, you know, you talk about no black president has had black interests at heart. Even a black president didn't have black interests at heart.
That's true.
But,
that's right.
But couldn't that be detrimental to his health? Excuse me?
Couldn't that be detrimental to his health? If he had a black interest at heart, couldn't that have been detrimental to his health? In other words,
he actually had a better hand than he played. Michelle Obama, she campaigned in New Hampshire. I believe New Hampshire was something like 95% to 98% white. Michelle Obama was talking about empathy and saying that the problem with America was that it had an empathy deficit, that it wasn't a question of, you know, any kind of economic deficit. But when Barack Obama got elected, all that talk of empathy, all that talk of fairness, he put that, you know, in his desk drawer somewhere. In fact, I would argue that one of the things that Donald Trump did is he saw the kind of hand that Barack Obama had and Barack Obama's unwillingness to play it. In fact, I like to use the metaphor that Barack Obama had a straight. He had at least a straight. But he played his straight like he had a pair of tens. Donald Trump has a pair of fours. He playing a pair of fours like he got a royal flush. And so that's part of our issue is that the community itself has to have a vision. And I think that right now, increasingly, the vision that black people have is that black people want power. that we want to manifest ourselves in the world. And now, you know, we're doing things, you know, to achieve that. So, I don't know, that's somebody else.
Let me go over here to Brother Oshi. Brother Oshi, how you doing tonight?
Hey, Doc Rogers, how you doing tonight?
Doing great.
Good. How's everybody doing?
Good.
Hi, brother.
Brother Oshi, what are your thoughts? I want you to also comment, Brother Oshi, on what your perspective is of the Miller Bruin situation that happened back here a couple of weeks ago. But anyway, any point you want to hone in on first?
Well, I mean, this is the politics of this country. Once again, being a Pan-Africanist, nationalist, I could have no faith at all in this system. I have no faith at all in the people who run this system. I'm deeply into conspiracies. If you present something to me and it's logical to me, knowing how Europeans are, I'll run with it. that's like the recent piece where the Caucasian from Harvard University worked with some Chinese in China. Supposedly they just arrested him. He's allegedly helped China develop the strain of the coronavirus. Because, you know, viruses have different strains, just like
right.
other bacteria. Once you are starting to defeat it, it mutates itself. It develops strength within itself.
Right.
And it changes. It's just like that joke that Richard Pryor said, you know, that this different strains of gonorrhea and syphilis, you know, got so bad that penicillin wouldn't do nothing. That's right, penicillin. Coming up in here, Penna. I got something for your ass. You know, and that's the reality.
Right.
You know, and so now the corona, because, you know, you see people have been throwing on Facebook where the coronavirus can be killed by Lysol. Well, that's not the coronavirus that we're dealing with. You know?
Different with
another
strain.
Coronavirus basically acts like, you know, excuse me, I'm sorry. When people get it, it's like pneumonia.
Okay.
This virus is like pneumonia. And if you have a weakened immune system, and of course, the older you get, the weaker your immune system is, particularly if you don't strengthen it, then you will be susceptible to it and you could die. You know, how many people are going to die from this globally? I don't know. I mean, if you're going to die in the United States, they're just about to get 100 people who have died in the United States from this. You know, but the bottom line is there will be no, there's no difference of any president in this country.
Yeah.
That's like they, you mentioned somebody who wrote a book and said there was not one president. There was not one. Of course, we were enamored with Kennedy, you know, until he was killed. You know, we were loving. And of course, we deeply love with Barack Obama. Just the whole idea of Barack Obama. I kind of differ with Brother Pugh. Barack Obama, anybody who takes the presidency of the United States, they do the bidding of Europeans, of Caucasians. They do the bidding of the system, and that is to help maintain and sustain the privilege that they created. You don't go outside of that.
I mean, even I had
a romanticism about Barack Obama when he was first elected. I stated that, to me, if electing Barack Obama, there is a measure, incremental measure of difference for us, then he's the right person. If there's less mass incarceration, better education, better health situation, you know, all of these things, if it's better, it's incremental, not monumental, but incrementally, yes, electing Barack Obama was the thing to do. But, of course, it was not. It's proven so. And then many of us said, well, he's got the first 4 years. Let's not ask him to do anything. Let's just be happy he's there. And then in the next 4 years, by getting him reelected, then, of course, we'll see the things he can do for us, which he did nothing. Hell, at least I hope that he pardoned Jack Johnson. Hell, Trump did that.
Pardoned
Jack Johnson. At least I hope he would have pardoned Marcus Garvey. He didn't do none of that. You know,
here's a tight question for you. Does Donald Trump represent the interest? Does Donald Trump advance the interests of America?
Does he advance the interests of America?
Yeah, does Donald Trump? You said anybody elected president of the United States has to advance the interests of America, and since those interests are antithetical to black people, we therefore cannot expect.
Brother Pugh?
the interests of America.
To a degree, he does. How could a man, because America is arrogant, America is selfish, America is greedy, America's deceitful, and Donald Trump embodies that. The other presidents had a facade. They were nice, like Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter is probably one of the nicest men. And, of course, you see what happened to him in the Iran situation, you know, that he couldn't defeat Reagan. He wasn't going to defeat Reagan anyway. Because, number one, you know, Jimmy Carter was talking about challenging the oil industry at that time in the late 70s, early 80s. And that just wasn't going to happen.
Right.
You know, he had put solar panels up on the White House saying that, you know, we need to look at changing the how we develop energy and so forth. That wasn't going to happen. So, no. Yes, Donald Trump, to some degree, he's a habitual liar. He's conniving. He's selfish. He's a racist.
Yeah.
He's greedy. Yeah. What do you think? You asked the question. What do you think?
So when you gave your answer, you said to a degree. So what that says then is that it is possible. In other words, one of the things about America is that there are different visions of what America's interests are. And that's where the challenge is that, you know, when you get people who are participating in generating the agenda that drives the president, then that means that there can be things on. In fact, one of the reasons that in the past there has not been straight out gangsterism in Africa. And in fact, the policy towards South Africa was what it was. Reagan wanted to do more for South Africa. It was because of black people. So, in other words, there are roles that we can play, and it's just a question of figuring out strategically what is the best way, you know, to use what few resources we have.
Right.
I got a question for Brother Oshie and Brother Pugh and all the people on the panel and the audience. My question to you is it a possibility, Brother Oshie and Brother Pugh, that a person can get there and dismantle it? I mean, can you go there and, like, take away, just turn around the weapons of mass destruction, turn around the situation with education, turn around all that America sits on, colonization and everything, and just dismantle it? It's possible. I'm not saying it's going to happen with this president or the next, but it's possible.
Well, that is exactly what Donald Trump is doing. That's what make America. In other words, when Donald Trump says something, if he says something positive, it's a lie. He's going to do the opposite of that. If he says something negative, it's a projection. So when he says he's going to make America great again, if you look at all the dimensions of American greatness, its military greatness, its financial greatness, its image in the world, et cetera, every one of these he's degrading, right? And so that's what his – remember I said he believes
what I'm saying
that,
is dismantle it to be positive. In other words, and like you and I know that Constitution is a piece of paper for some people, when it came to King and Malcolm, Thurgood Marshall, the Constitution meant everything. So I'm stating that dismantle it to work in favor of humanity and people.
Right. It's called transformation. That's what Dr. King talked about, is this ideal of transformation away from militarism.
But let me just say this. You know, one thing is clear to me and to many other scholars, African-centered scholars, that the European is the immortal enemy of African people. There is nothing in them. They will not change. But yet we hold our hope. We pray. We think that what they write is just and honest. No. It's a waste of damn time.
Right. Oh, see, I'm for what you're saying also. I'm for what you're saying also. But I'm just saying, I didn't say that the person had to be white, but I hope the person is this year is black in his mind and has pan-Africanism and nationalism and all the isms that we need that's going to help humanity. Now, I'm specifically talking about black people, if you want to get down to it. I said humanity.
Well,
about black people.
Well, one of the things about Europeans is that, you know, you act as if they're some homogeneous people,
the reality is they've been killing each other big time ever since we've known them.
Yeah.
So, you know, in other words, they, without question, they've done some things to us, but they've done the same thing to each other.
When they came out of that dark age, that medieval age, and you're right, they were constantly at war with each other. And they tried, of course, to get rid of the Moors in Western Spain. But when they came out of that, they looked at each other and said, wait a minute, Martel and Charlemagne, wait a minute. When we war amongst ourselves, but we're going to come together on those who are outside of us, those who are now be called non-white. We're going to come to European Caucasian extremism, racism, and privilege, better known as white supremacy, is a team sport. It's a global phenomenon.
Right.
So, yes, I agree with you, Pew, but the bottom line is they intrinsically believe that it's their divine right, their manifest destiny to rule over this planet. And they do it in all kinds of ways.
Well, you know what? Just before I came on the program, one of the other things I was reading is Francis Bacon, and he was the one who came up with the new science and this idea that we're going to learn nature so that we can control nature. But there was another fellow that I was reading at the same time, this German philosopher named Fichte. And his whole concept, you know, he considered himself a Lutheran, and he was threatened by the mechanism and the atomism of the view that Francis Bacon had. And so what I'm saying to you is that the whole Hitler and Nazism arose from the thinking of this German Fichte in his response to what Francis Bacon was doing. So here's what I'm saying in the most simple terms. White people are advancing what they believe to be in their interest, but all of them don't see the world in the same way, and none of them see the world the way that mature human beings would see the world. What that does is that gives us an option. In other words, if you've got two teenagers who have guns and they're doing things irresponsibly, on the one hand, you know, you can stay away from them and make sure they don't shoot you. On the other hand, you can show them how they could grow up and how they could actually live in harmony with themselves and their environment. That's the challenge we have. In other words, when you go and you actually look at what white people have said about themselves, you'll see that they don't understand how to be human beings. That we have.
But
the problem is that when you look at black intellectuals, they don't see that. What black intellectuals do, the fundamental drive of black intellectuals is they just want what white people got. In other words, they say that they're upset with white people, but they just want what white people have.
Well, I have a question. What about Nkrumah? Let's take Nkrumah and let's take Nnamdi Azikiwe. And what did they do in their countries that we would like to have global pan-Africanism and nationalism? Look at, like the president general said, Marcus Garvey. Let's look at Mugabe. Let's look at Amilcar Cabral. Let's look at a black mind, and I have a black mindset on making the world black again, the beginning.
But that's what I'm saying. Those are not black mindsets. If you look at Marcus Garvey and what he was doing, fundamentally, what does Marcus Garvey look like? He looked like Napoleon. He's wearing, you know, one of them tri-stars and whatnot. In other words, their vision of what it meant to be great people was the vision that white people had as to what
That's
it
wrong,
meant to
no.
be great
but,
people.
Brother Pugh, I'm a socialist. Okay, but listen to me. No. But Brother Pugh, with work, you got it. You can't. You get the right administration on you. You have to work. You can't be one man with this. You got to be a government of people going in a direction with all kinds of ideas. If you're gonna be by yourself, you got to be a government of people with the ideas who are constantly evolving.
Okay. Yes, and that's one of the things. In fact, one of my guys, what's his name, Cedric, Cedric Robinson.
Yeah.
He does an analysis that goes and looks at indigenous African peoples and look at African ways to rule the world. And by the way, the Egyptians did what what Alexander the Great and them were doing and all that. That's that empire-building nonsense. Yeah. That's not what our ancestors did. Okay. So what I'm saying is that, you know, so it's a complex topic, but...
it is. And this is a very good discussion, and I'm glad. But Brother Oshie, I want to come back to you. We don't have about 15, 20 minutes. I want to come back and ask you, what are your thoughts on the Miller Brewing situation? What are some of your ideas around that?
Well, I think it's an unfortunate situation. The brother who worked at Miller Brewing Company for quite a while, who was being harassed at Miller Brewing Company, and he called into question his harassment to his employer, and he was terminated. And I'm not sure who his attorneys were or how he fought, but he fought. He got his job back.
Right.
And then, yet, Miller Brewing Company maintained that, okay, you got your job back, but did not correct the problem that precipitated from him getting his job, so he was harassed again.
Right.
Consistently.
Right.
And this time he was fired again. And I guess in his mind, I have no recourse. I'm tired of what they have done to me. I'm tired of them doing this to me. So he got a gun with a silencer on it, and he got a fake ID. I'm not sure how long it was before he was terminated this time to when he actually did the shooting. But he went up in there, and he went to the department where those guys were, and he killed them.
Yeah.
He killed those who had tormented him, who had made fun of him, who ridiculed him, demeaned, degraded him.
Mm-hmm.
Because he couldn't – the Miller Brewing Company wouldn't fire him.
Nope.
I'm not sure what Miller Brewing Company did, if they did anything at all,
yeah.
A suspension or whatever.
And very so clearly, that environment, important. That Miller Brewing
right.
environment
exactly.
was real bad.
And so then, because of that, then you heard others who came out and said the same thing about Miller Brewing Company's behavior by allowing individuals that work at Miller Brewing Company. But one thing, too, we're talking about what? Milwaukee,
right.
Wisconsin. One of the most segregated cities in this country, which a lot of cities can make that claim, of course, justifiably. But, I mean, with a history and defined lines of segregation, with a police chief, Harold Brown, who was on a par with Bull Connor in Birmingham, Alabama.
That's right.
You know, so you had all of those dynamics.
That's
and
right.
So, you know... When it first came out, you know, I listened to the national news. See, I'm here in Atlanta. I'm listening to the national news. Everything about that situation was on this brother. There was no mention, of course, his being harassed, him being terminated, getting his job back, him consistently being harassed. None of that was mentioned.
Right.
You know, until finally, sometime later, then there were some things on Facebook and nothing still on the national news, because once they reported the way they did, there's nothing to say that you know, there was nothing that they could say to say, well, this man did this out of response, and yes, we don't condone this, and I don't condone it, but he felt that was his only recourse, and I understand it.
Yeah.
I understand it. And so, you know.
Did you hear that one of the people that was taunting him did not get shot that day, but a couple of days later committed suicide. Did you hear that?
No, I didn't.
Yeah, that seems to be what happened, and it was public. It was news. It was broadcast that he was considered to be one of those that had taunted him. He wasn't there that day or something, and but somehow or the other the pressure, and he committed suicide. And so I think that the traumatic psychoanalysis of this whole incident is definitely worthy of our understanding and consideration. Because, like you said, Miller Brewing at that particular time was now owned by South Africans.
Right.
Philip Morris had sold it to Coors, and Coors sold it to South Africans.
Right.
And so when this happened, it seemed that some of that mentality of South Africa, you know, a lot of the apartheid system of South Africa was able to exist because they had made so much money in their breweries. That was their key area. So anyway, I thought maybe it was worthy of us discussing and mentioning because it seems to undergird all of the things that we are going through and things that we are talking about right now and how that works. And there's probably other places in the country the same way. I mean, other businesses like
sure.
that. Yeah, I'm sure.
Dr. Rogers.
Oh, believe me.
Yeah. Sister Yan?
Dr. Rogers?
Uh-huh. Yes.
Yes, I want to step in for a minute because as I'm listening to the dialogue, to the conversation, it's just reminding me of how critical it is for black folk to deal with our issues of trauma
right.
That results from oppression and torture yeah. and torment right. in this country.
Right, right.
One evidence of trauma is that you continue to try to get a predator to not be a predator so that they'll leave you alone. That's not going to happen. This country has organized contempt against black folk, and that will not end.
Right.
I don't care how multicultural, multiracial, whatever, that's not going to end. That's been ongoing forever. And so our focus needs to be on how we're going to heal ourselves and begin to come back together because we're extremely fragmented. And with all the attacks against us, what are we going to fight back with?
Yeah.
Aside from our ideas.
Right.
And looking back and how we used to be.
And our ancestors did that. They fought back like that. They did. They really
yes,
did.
Yes, yes. Yeah. But here's the point I want to make. Here's where I'm going with this.
Yes.
Stop. And that's that this torment is driving us to begin to, like the brother you were talking about, Miller Brewing Company,
yeah.
I hadn't heard about that. But I've heard of other situations where black men are getting sick and tired of being tormented,
right.
and they're killing white people.
Yeah, yeah.
And the other thing is black women. I'm speaking as you know, bringing in that womb that you always talk about. Black women, we are pissed. Black women are angry because we are tired of seeing our babies killed and murdered.
Mm-hmm.
And as we talk about mm-hmm. presidents and electoral process and whatnot, mm-hmm. none of that is going to stop. The militarism, the violence workers who are the police, none of that is going to stop the attacks against us.
Right.
So at the end of the day, we still have to go back to how we're going to take care of ourselves. This country is about perpetuating, maintaining white supremacy. It doesn't matter who's in the president's office. You got a retard there. He's just doing the bidding of, you know, the powers that be. Barack Obama did the same thing. He did the bidding of the powers that be.
Yes.
There are things he wanted to do that were halfway decent. They wouldn't allow him to. Well, we need to take our heads out of the sand and look at the reality. There are young black women who are ready to fight, ready to take up arms.
Mm-hmm.
And we're becoming the loudest voices because we're seeing our men taken away.
Okay.
So just to, you know, remind us of what's really important, we can't fix the world. We can't fix ourselves. But we want to unite everybody. That's just not realistic.
No, it's not.
I can't help anybody if my legs are broken. I gotta heal my legs.
And your voice.
And right now,
your
we're
voice.
Like people with broken legs talking about a dying empire. We better save ourselves.
Yeah.
Well, here's the strongest hand that black people have. One of the things that white people did is that they assumed, well, hold it now. If we have everything of value, why is it that those people are able to sing songs and what are they happy about, right? Well, I would say to you that. One of the strongest forces that we have is an example. In other words, if we show other people how to be human beings, other people want to do that. That's what being cool is all about. When you see somebody walking in such a way and you feel like, oh, yeah, I wish I could walk like that. Well, I'm saying that if we begin to do that kind of thing, that will cause other people to want to emulate us and then begin to move in another way. That's where most of our strength is in our example.
Brother Pugh, that's
brother
what we're
Pugh,
doing.
Pugh.
We have been doing that. Can I just say
that?
This quickly? We have been doing that ever since we're brought here. We've been emulating what it's like to be human, forgiving them, you know, helping, turning the other cheek.
Right.
embracing Christianity, which distort our minds. We've been doing that. It's not working fast enough. By the time we make any kind of significant success, we'll be eliminated. That is my concern. There are young women out here that don't have a black man to marry because they're locked up. So we have got to take care of ourselves. White folk need to take care of that. There are many conscious white folk, many white folks that are, you know, anti-capitalist, all that other stuff. It's their responsibility to teach their people how to be humane now. We gotta fix ourselves.
Well, there's a writer, Brittany Cooper, and she has an expression, you go get your people. In other words, her argument is that I'm bringing my people, and she's telling white people who say that they're allies. I think they're using the word now, not allies, on co-conspirators. In other words, you prepared to make the same kind of sacrifices I'm prepared to make. And what she's basically saying is that, you know, I'm not responsible to go in your community and get your people. You're
exactly
responsible
right.
to do that, and so on. But I mean, you know, so I'm seeing signs that, you know, folks are making moves, and you know, so.
Right.
But on the other hand, you know, we got some serious enemies, and they doing some things too. So you know, it's one of them. You know, it ain't all victory, but it ain't all losses either.
Well, listen, folks, we are at the end of the our time. We really appreciate your input. Excellent conversation tonight, even though we got off kind of late, but we were able to cover some ground and to looking at some of the key issues going on around us. Thank all of you for being here and your patience. And don't forget, those of you that are listening, Brother Oshie will be on tomorrow at 11 o'clock Eastern Time, 10 p.m. Central Time, listening to his struggle in African Perspectives. Again, thank you so much. Have a good week. We will be back here again next week. Have a great week.
We all agree tonight, all of the speakers have agreed, that America has a very serious problem. Not only does America have a very serious problem, but our people have a very serious problem. America's problem is
self-destruction. Get it for self-destruction.
It really ain't the rap audience is bugging. It's one or two suckers, ignorant brothers, trying to rob and steal from one another. You get caught in the mid. So to crush that stereotype, here's what we did. We got ourselves together so that you could unite and fight for what's right. Not negative cause. The way we live is positive. We don't kill our relatives.
Pop, 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 when it's shot, who's to blame? Headlines, front page, and rap's the name. MC Delight here to state the bottom line. The black on black crime was way before our time.
Took a brother's life with a knife as his wife cried, cause he died a trifling death when he left his very last breath. Was I slept, so watch your step. Back in the 60s, our brothers and sisters were hanged. How could you gang bang? I never ever ran from the Ku Klux Klan, and I shouldn't have to run from a black man, cause that's
self-destruction. Yeah, it was self-destruction. Self-destruction. Yeah, it was self-destruction.
Funky fresh dress to impress, ready to party. Money in your pocket, dying to move your body. To get inside, you pay the whole $10. Scotch tape with a razor blade, tape to your collar. Leave the guns in the crack and the knobs alone. MC Lights on the microphone. Bum rushing and pushing, snatching and taxing. I crammed to understand why brothers don't be maxing. There's only one disco, they'll close one more. You ain't guarding the door. So what you got a gun for? Do you rob the rich and give to the